Today's story is one of my all-time favorite scenes with Jesus. This story is told only in the Gospel according to John, the only place we find it, and it happens right after the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptizer, right after the calling of the very first disciples. In the Gospel according to John, it is not healing the sick, it is not casting out unclean spirits, it is not preaching or teaching or walking on water. It is this: turning water into wine at a wedding party. The very first act, the inaugural event of the public ministry of Jesus. Now that is a Jesus worth following. So, what it is we often call the miracles of Jesus, the feeding of the 5,000, for example, the healing of illnesses, the casting out of spirits, walking on water, and even this transformation of water into wine at the wedding feast at Cana. These miraculous things in the Gospel according to John in particular are called signs. You'll notice they're not called miracles, but signs. And that's a difference that we should pay attention to. We, and surely those who first heard and experienced them, were dazzled and puzzled and maybe awed by what happened. But the point, as a sign, the point is not the event itself, not the miraculous event itself, but a sign always points beyond itself to something that is really real beyond it. For example, a traffic sign that says a U-turn is coming up, or a sign for a restroom. You actually want the restroom and not the sign. The sign is helpful to get you to the reality that you actually need. We're challenged to see beyond the miracle, the dazzling miracle, to look deeper than the surface amazement of what happened, to see what lies behind, to recognize what it is that was revealed and to what it points. Today is the final of four sermons that I'm doing during the season of Epiphany, which ends next Sunday, in fact. And these sermons have highlighted the connection that I believe exists between Epiphany and this other concept, Theophany. Epiphany, which means appearance or manifestation, the kind of aha moment of divine revelation. And Theophany, which more specifically means the appearance of a God, somehow a manifestation of an invisible, ineffable, spiritual God is perceptible in the physical world. And it's because in those terms, it seems appropriate that the long-standing Christian claim that God was incarnate in Jesus Christ, I think that that is a claim of theophany, that God was made seeable and hearable and touchable and followable in this decisive and sustained way. So the sermons have alternated between traditional Epiphany stories and theophany stories. To recap, the first week, you may recall, was probably the most famous theophany story, that story where Moses turns aside to see the curious sight of a bush that was burning but not consumed, and where he hears the voice of God revealing the divine name, also calling him to be the great deliverer of the Hebrews from their oppression and slavery in Egypt. The second was the story of Jesus as he calls his first disciples along the Sea of Galilee. It's a traditional Epiphany story because somehow in hearing that simple and direct invitation of Jesus, "Follow me," they recognized that there was something of God that they could not resist. Last week, we went to another theophany. That was the story of how God appears to Abraham as three unknown travelers at his desert tent, and how it is that the welcome and the hospitality displayed by Abraham and Sarah and their household, whether it was an inconvenience or not at the time, it was the circumstance for the revelation of God's presence and God's promise. So today is another story. in some ways, another interaction of how the needs of the guests and the hosts intersect, and they reveal the divine presence. And this story, the wedding feast at Canaan, is a traditional Epiphany story. So what's the aha? Well, the story goes, as we heard, Mary, the mother of Jesus, along with Jesus and his followers, seems though Mary was the primary invited person, are in attendance at this wedding party in a nearby town, nearby their hometown of Nazareth, also in Galilee, but in Canaan. They were attending a wedding party. Now, in the ancient Near East, wedding parties were not just an afternoon reception. They could last for days at a time because people often traveled a great distance, needed housing and lodging and food for days. This was a big deal, a big party that could last several days. Now, we are given no clue as to what kind of relationship Mary or Jesus and his followers may have had to receive this invitation, be it friends, be it family, we simply don't know. But somehow, there's a close enough relationship that Mary, the mother of Jesus, becomes aware that the wine has given out. Now, that went well, we're chuckling. I don't think that Mary drank most of it. Well, who knows? Who knows? We don't know. She was a troublemaker, contrary to our placid, our feelings about her. The wine had given out. Mary knew that, and it was something that would have been a huge embarrassment, a social shame, in fact, upon the wedding couple and the families who had provided the feast. So it's Mary's attention and her pointing it out to Jesus that actually sets the events in motion. Now, after she points it out to her son, in a way that sounds, quite frankly, rather cold and distant, if not downright sort of mouthing off to his mother, he says, "Woman, what concern is that to you and me? My hour has not yet come." Is Jesus talking back to his mother? Frankly says more or less, "So what? Who cares?" With this little theological interjection at the end, we're to understand that Jesus does know what his mother seems to be asking, but he says the timing isn't right yet. So his mother turns to the servants and says, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, doesn't this sound like a family thing? Doesn't this sound like family communication? Jesus says, "So what?" Mary says, "Whatever." And Mary, it seems, has a bit of an upper hand in this situation, perhaps a closer relationship. So Jesus notices these six stone water jars that are for the water for ritual purification, the Jewish rites of purification, and each of them holds 20 or 30 gallons. Now, even for purification, that's a lot of water. Those are lots of jugs and lots of water. It's excessive. It's intentionally excessive, by the way. Jesus says to the servants, "Go and fill those jars with water." And they filled them up, all of them. That's about 150 gallons or more, give or take, 150 gallons. So the servants are actually doing the heavy lifting in this miracle story. Let's give it up for the servants. They helped make it happen. And Jesus says to them, "Now, draw some out and take it to the chief steward." And the steward tastes this water, which for the first time, we're told, has become wine, and didn't know where it came from. He was the steward. He was supposed to know where all of this was from. So he hastens to the bridegroom and memorably says, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after all the guests have become drunk. But you saved the good wine until now." Now, we have no idea whether the steward or the wedding couple ever learn where this excellent wine came from unexpectedly, but we know the servants know, and we know the disciples also know from whence it came. They came to believe. It's interesting to notice that John provides us a lot of detail in this story, and there's a lot of action that's going on, more than just Jesus turning the water into wine, from Mary noticing to the servants lifting and carrying to the wine steward. Kind of takes a village to make this miracle happen. You like that? You can use that right there. But what is this miracle? What is this sign? Toward what is it pointing? Now, we could want to see this as a story about Jesus somehow having a miraculous and mysterious power that he was able to rearrange the molecules of wine, of water into wine. Now, the Enlightenment would certainly have rejected that idea. The ancient world wouldn't have thought it that. It would have been amazing and unusual, but certainly possible. And you know, if you saw the movie, oh gosh, 10 or 12 years ago, What the Bleep Do We Know? Anyone remember that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? Or in other ways, know a little bit about quantum science. That leap from water molecule to wine molecule is really not as big of a leap as we might like to think in our rational minds. But I actually think this sign is inviting us to look beyond even that, to something else. This is a symbolic story, a deeply symbolic story, because of its extravagance, its overabundance. That's part of why the sign cannot be missed. Ancient Jewish theology and writings anticipated that the coming of God's reign of love and justice and peace had long been described as an overabundance of wine would be the sign that God's age had begun. And throughout the Bible, the fulfillment of the faithful when they are in union with God is often described as a great and cosmic wedding banquet. So this is a sign that God's presence had drawn near. The new age had begun. So to paraphrase, let's get this party started. We have 150 gallons of wine now. But I wonder, is it also a sign of something more? We're told that these large stone jars into which the water was poured were the jars that were dedicated for the waters for purification. Now, that was sacred washing, yes, of course, but it was washing nonetheless. This was to be wash water. When filled, these jars were not for drinking water, but destined to be bath water. Bath water. Water that would become dirty and be cast aside. And it was that water that was changed into the finest wine. The most ordinary thing that was changed into something extraordinary. Bath water into the best wine. I think we still tend to live with this myth that there is a great gulf that divides the common stuff in our lives and the holy stuff of God. Does it ever feel that way in your life? That there is somehow this huge divide between the common stuff that happens in my life and the stuff that is God's stuff? And I believe this is a sign that says all along, lying just behind, just beyond that which we're paying attention to, the wedding feast is already underway. The wine is already there, even when it seems to have run out. Is this first sign of Jesus a sign of how powerfully the presence of Jesus could bless and awaken people to the wonder that was all around them and within them, that even within bathwater was intoxicating goodness, that the ordinary was extraordinary and joyful, that there is a value and a holiness in every life to be revealed, that the everyday is extraordinary. That is the sign of God's work. The second reading from the Unauthorized Bible by Gary Holthouse, which Jason read so beautifully. The Unauthorized Bible is actually not much more than a pamphlet-sized, tiny little book, and it doesn't even seek to be a translation or a paraphrase of Scripture. That should be clear. But Gary Holthouse uses different portions of Scripture as an inspiration to write in the style, but in a modern idiom. He uses excerpts from the Hebrew Bible, from the prophets, from the Beatitudes. This is using an inspiration from one of the letters of Paul, where Paul has spoken about the value of the Last Supper, communion. And in his writing, he called, little man, by the way, is what he refers to Jesus throughout. Never uses the word Jesus or the name, little man who drives around in a Ford Pinto, by the way, is kind of how he describes it. So, yeah. It's a really, really lovely little book. But in this, Gary Holthouse invites us to experience things, invites us to cultivate the spirit of a mystic, that form which we see in front of us is never all that there is in God. There is something that is behind the wine, the fruit, and behind the fruit. There is something that is behind the bread, the grain, and behind the grain, the soil. And behind the soil, behind the bathwater even, behind the wedding wine, the stuff of stars. Even scientists would agree with that nowadays. But for people of faith, it points us one step farther. In an epiphany, in a theophany, we wake up. Our vision clears. The veil is parted, so to speak, for just a moment, perhaps. Because behind a bush that is burning but not consumed, behind the voice of a stranger that beckons, follow me, behind the presence of three desert-weary travelers, behind gallon upon gallon of bathwater. What if behind all that and all that and all that, we discover the best and most intoxicating thing of all, the very presence of God?